When you're ready to pop the question, the last thing you want to do is second-guess the ring. At BlueNile.com, you can design a one-of-a-kind ring with the ease and convenience of shopping online. Choose your diamond and setting. When you find the one, you'll get it delivered right to your door. Go to BlueNile.com and use promo code LISTEN to get $50 off your purchase of $500 or more. That's code LISTEN at BlueNile.com for $50 off your purchase. BlueNile.com, code LISTEN.
Welcome to History Hack. If you didn't know by now, we are the revolution. That means we're sharp, witty, lots of fun, but it also means that we're essentially the peasants in Les Mis huddled round a table in the corner of the bar with no money. If you enjoy the show, please do support us. We have a Patreon account by which you can donate a small monthly sum in appreciation of what you're hearing. Alternatively, we have Ko-fi, in which you can just do a one-off donation as a thank you if you particularly enjoy a certain episode. Either way, we massively appreciate all of your support. Hope you enjoy the show. Hello and welcome to today's History Hack. I have Miss Charlie White with me today. Hello, Charlie.
Hello, how are you today, my love?
I'm all right. You're not here for early modern though, are you?
No, I'm very confused. I'm going well out of my comfort zone today, but I love that. That's what I love about the hack. So today, we're joined by Paul Cooper, who's a writer and a historian, whose previous books include the historical novels River of Ink and All Our Broken Idols. But he's here today to talk to us about his brand new history book, Fall of Civilizations, Stories of Greatness and Decline. Hello, Paul.
Hello. Thanks for having me on the show.
We're really interested in this because, you know, civilizations falling sounds like a lot of fun. I can think of a lot of obvious ones, but I know we're going to kind of steer away from the most obvious falls today, like the glory that was Rome.
Yeah, that's right. I think over the course of my show, I've tried to steer away from some of the more stereotypical stories of civilizational collapse, although I have told the story of the fall of Rome in miniature in certain other stories. Kind of begins the story of Byzantium, and also it's kind of part of the story of Roman Britain as well.
Incredible. Well, I'm looking forward to learning a lot today, but I'm going to drag you into early modern. Let's start in the 17th century, shall we, Paul? So Mesopotamia, 1625. What did our friend Pietro della Valle find in the 17th century?
So Pietro della Valle is a really interesting historical character. He was a composer, a polymath, this wealthy noble who just loved learning and traveling. Yeah. And when he had a broken heart in Italy, it's this wonderful Italian story. And he began to, he was on the verge of suicide. And his friends told him, you have to go traveling. You have to get away from Italy. Go and see the world. So he sets out on this amazing journey across the Middle East. He cures his broken heart. He meets a Syrian Christian princess in Damascus who he marries. And with her, he then travels across what we know as the Middle East today, where the Ottoman and Persian empires were at the time at war. So this was a place that was in a lot of upheaval. But he was traveling across it through the deserts of what is Mesopotamia, the Tigris-Euphrates Valley. And as he went, he and his group were suddenly menaced by a group of Bedouin they saw on the horizon. They saw these figures and weren't quite sure what their intentions were. And so they fled and went to seek shelter and saw in the distance a group of enormous brick ruins. And Della Valle writes in amazingly kind of terse words about fleeing across the desert to these ruins where they have to hide. And as he's there, he explores. He begins to walk around this mass of broken masonry where he can find pieces of writing that are inscribed on clay bricks.
This sounds like the beginning of The Mummy with Brendan Fraser.
Yeah, yes. Yeah, it's very much like that. It's the story of exploration in the mysterious East, which is the stuff of exactly that kind of story. Yeah, and it's amazing because the experience he describes walking around this broken ruin that he didn't know, but we now know was the ruin of Ur, a city that was at the heart of a civilization known as the Sumerians, which was one of the oldest cultures that we have a consistent historical record for. They were some of the first people to ever set down words in clay. And this experience of walking around Ur and finding these bits of broken clay with writing on is one you can have today. And I visited some of these sites myself, and even now, because a lot of it has not really been properly excavated by archaeologists, you can walk around these sites like Uruk and Ur, Nimrud, and find bricks just stamped with ancient writing that was probably laid down, you know, 2,000, 3,000, even 4,000 years ago. Even some of the signs that Della Valle describes seeing, an eight-pointed star, are very, very obvious in some of the clay tablets you can still see.
What kind of thing is he finding? I mean, do we now know what was written on these tablets? Or did he have any idea, or was it just strange markings?
Well, he had no idea, because cuneiform as a writing system wouldn't be deciphered until the 19th century. By this painstaking process that's almost like doing a kind of 1,000-piece Sudoku. It's really remarkable piece of intellectual discovery. But for Della Valle, they were completely mysterious objects of curiosity. And in fact, cuneiform hadn't been used as a writing system for, you know, 1,500 years by that point.
It's amazing. I think one of the most moving things I've ever seen, and I didn't even know existed till the tour guide took it to us, we were in Lima, and it's just this big mound that everyone until the 70s, in the 70s, I think kids were using it as a BMX riding place, because it was like a really steep hill. And then they realized that actually what was underneath it was like a 600 pyramid of mud bricks, and every single one of the bricks has got the fingerprints of the guys who pushed them into place. So it's like, I think I'm going to ask you later if you think we found all the best ones there are to find it and everything. But this book has a huge span, doesn't it? You go back to the late Bronze Age collapse in one place and that. But is what made you, which one made you want to write the book? Because there must have been one where you were like, yeah, I want to write about this.
Well, I began the podcast, which the book is, you know, the written version of. The one that really inspired me was honestly Roman Britain. I was learning about this period where the Roman Empire left Britain in 410 AD. And, you know, in lots of parts of the Roman Empire, the collapse of the Western Roman Empire wasn't that big a deal. It didn't really change your everyday life in an enormous way. You know, if you lived in France, you know, which was Gaul at the time, you would have seen some disruption. There was probably, you know, so a bit of warfare and violence and so on. But really, you were just paying taxes to a different guy now, and life would have more or less continued for the average peasant. If you lived in Constantinople or Egypt, you would have noticed no difference at all. Everything was continuing just as it had been. But in Britain, partly due to our island nation status, our disconnectedness from the mainland, and partly due to the unique way that Rome had integrated with our society, the removal of the Roman Empire and its entire army caused essentially an economic collapse. Overnight, you had whole categories of objects like soup pots or metal hobnails in boots, coffin nails, disappeared overnight. People just simply stopped being buried in coffins because we no longer had nails. We no longer produced new metal, so people had to begin scavenging for the metal that was already in the cities, and slowly they dismantled the Roman cities. We no longer cut stone or masonry, so people had to pull apart the Roman buildings in order to build new ones. For 200 years after the Romans leave, London was essentially a ghost town. It had been a thriving Roman city, but it became, you know, empty streets, wild dogs wandering around it, ivy and elder growing over the stones, the Roman Forum and churches, you know, completely disintegrating and collapsing. And it was that feeling that London, our capital city, had once been almost like the stuff of science fiction, you know, the stuff of The Last of Us or one of these dystopian, you know, post-apocalyptic stories. I really wanted to find, you know, not just tell the story of what happened when the Roman Empire had collapsed, but what happened next and what it felt like to live through that period.
What did it feel like? I mean, it just must have been, for the people left behind, it must have been just like the world had ended, or was it good? Were people Do you think people were happy because, you know, these sort of overlords have left, but then we don't have any of this stuff anymore that we're quite used to? We like this stuff, metal and stone cutting and all these kind of things.
Yeah, I mean, it's undoubtedly their reactions were probably quite complex, to say the least. As you say, you know, there was, the Roman Empire was built on a lot of violence and oppression. You know, people who opposed it were put down with utter cruelty. But it also brought a lot of luxuries and amenities and comforts, especially if you lived in the urban cores. And one of the challenges of writing about civilizational collapse is that often the first thing to go is our ability to record, is the writing. So as far as we know, British people didn't write anything for 150 years after 410 AD when the Romans left, until Gildas comes along. You know, he's a monk and begins to write the first histories, where we start to get a hazy idea of what happened. And he's quite confused about some of the details and thinks Hadrian's Wall was built by the Britons and so on. But we do get a sense in other collapses of what it felt like, because one of the main responses people have had to the feeling that society is coming apart is to write poetry, is to write elegies and laments and sorrowful outpourings of emotion about this was the world we knew. We thought it would last forever, and now it's dying, or it's dead. It's a feeling of immense emotional dislocation that people have always wanted to put down in writing.
Isn't that incredible? It's like almost there comes time where actually history and recorded fact is not needed or is missing, and art picks up the slack. So you've got all of that through, like you say, through artistic ways of looking at things.
That's absolutely right. Even the Sumerians, who, as I said, were, you know, the first people really to write anything down, once their society begins to come apart around 2000 BC, they begin writing laments for each of their cities that have collapsed. So one of the most famous being the Lament for Ur, the city that Pietro della Valle was visiting. And in it they write that the city's god has fled like a bird flying its roost. The sense that the protective forces that once let the society flourish are now kind of flying away. It's very moving.
Are there any in there that, have you managed to find any? Because obviously everyone's heard of Rome. You've got things in there like the Mayan as well. Any that you think people would be like, I have never heard of that civilization in my life, and they're actually quite a big deal?
Yeah, I think I get that response most often for the Indian Empire I looked at, Vijayanagara, which, you know, the history of India, I think, is really overlooked in most common retellings of human history. It's just this absolutely fascinating drama that unfolds over centuries. It felt really good to bring that to the podcast audience, and also to return to it in the book.
Who are they? Can we have a little potted, who were they? When were they? Because again, I know nothing about them, because they've been ignored.
Yeah, Vijayanagara is a absolutely fascinating kingdom. It's a medieval kingdom that rises in the south of India, and is looked on sometimes today as a kind of bastion of Hindu culture. Because the story of the Middle Ages in India is the expansion of Islam in the north. You have the Delhi Sultanate in the north, which was the kind of heartland of Indian Muslim culture. But over the Middle Ages, that slowly spread southward until you have the Bahmani Sultanate in the Deccan Plateau. And these are powerful, cultured, sophisticated Muslim societies that are connected to a system of learning, with the libraries in Baghdad, with the Central Asian countries that are experimenting with gunpowder, cannon warfare. They're sophisticated cultures that the southern Indians are looking up to, but also very frightened of. And they begin to unite in South India in order to form a kind of a bastion to say, we're going to remain Hindu. The dramas of Vijayanagara are particularly exciting. You have kingly murders and plots and so on. But really, it's the ruins that I think are the most striking. Today you can visit them at the site of Hampi in Karnataka, where you just get these amazing crumbling temples that are set in this wonderful landscape of enormous boulders and just monkeys clambering over the whole thing. And the Tungabhadra River flowing nearby.
There's certain places as well, like that I think of, where I know they exist and I know someone impressive must have built them, but I know absolutely nothing else. And I know Charlie's going to agree with me because I know she knows nothing about Angkor Wat either. It looks lovely.
Yeah. No, I mean, there are all these places that, you know, I mean, Hampi's on the hippie trail in India. So, you know, the moment you get there, people are serving bang lassies and pizzas and so on. A lot of these ruins kind of become decontextualized and separated from the stories of the people who built them and become kind of admired as purely aesthetic objects. But you also get in Machu Picchu in Peru and Angkor Wat. You know, they become touristic icons that really you're just kind of there to take a photo of yourself in front of. Maybe you'll get some artistic shots of it. But
you'd be laughing at the guy that was at Machu Picchu 3 days before me, a 27-year-old German who died taking a selfie.
No. Wow.
Yeah, you know when you come in via the, not via the trekking entrance, via the front entrance, there's like a stone, it just looks like a normal house up on the top. He was leaning out the window for a selfie.
Wow.
Fool. But what's interesting is they are massively iconic. And one thing I learned in Peru was that the Incans, we think of as this epic civilization. And then the guides there tell you, no, they rose and fell as quick as the others. They're just the ones we have stuff for, even though no one can figure out what the coloured string is all about and how that works. But like, they just happen to be the one. Like, there was that pyramid buried under Lima. That's another one we just don't know anything about in comparison. So it's mad, isn't it?
Yeah, South American archaeology is a really exciting place to study at the moment because so much is being uncovered constantly and the story is constantly being revised and updated. Places like Corral, where there's 5,000 BC pyramid. No, I mean, the thing about the Aztecs and the Inca, we think of these as being ancient ruins. But, you know, the Aztecs, the Mexica people arrived in the Valley of Mexico around the year 1200 and, you know, were there for a couple of centuries before the Spanish arrived. You know, the Inca had a similarly short-lived time on the imperial stage. You know, these were thriving medieval kingdoms that were kind of snuffed out by colonial powers in their heights. That's why they make some of the most incredible stories, I think.
And I think, like, we have the Inca story because the Spanish turned up while it was their turn, which is weird. I love that in Cusco they have the Last Supper of their own version, but the Last Supper is a gerbil, a guinea pig, sorry.
Yeah, there's a guinea pig in it.
And Judas has the face of the Spanish conqueror, which funny as well. It was good fun, but yeah.
No, it's true. A lot of those early sources, like the Huarochirí manuscript or, you know, people like Juan de Betanzos, or they were writing these kind of compendiums of Inca or Mexica history in Mexico. But they were doing so kind of to learn more about this culture so that it could be more effectively converted to, you know, Catholic Christianity. So a lot of these kind of pieces of folklore and mythology are being preserved in a kind of condemnatory way. They're being viewed as devils. These are the kind of practices we want to stamp out more effectively. And so we need to learn more about them. It's actually one of the ironies of the Mayan people once the Europeans arrived is that one of the priests who's tasked with the Inquisition of the Mayan people, you know, stamping out their demonic indigenous beliefs, he kept quite detailed notes of the Mayan alphabet that have actually been instrumental in its decoding today. Probably without his notes, we wouldn't be able to read Mayan inscriptions. So the story of that colonial contact is full of those kinds of paradoxes and ironies.
I was just going to say, there's also the sentiment that these people fell because they're not as smart as we are today. And yet, like, again, like, because it's the one I've seen the most of, the Incans can cut stone to a precision that we didn't figure out till we had lasers and no one knows how they did it.
All of this, you know, indigenous cultures of the Americas were incredibly ingenious. They, you know, not only pre-contact, but post-contact, you know, the moment Europeans arrived.
When you're ready to pop the question, the last thing you want to do is second guess the ring. At BlueNile.com, you can design a one-of-a-kind ring with the ease and convenience of shopping online. Choose your diamond and setting. When you find the one, you'll get it delivered right to your door. Go to BlueNile.com and use promo code LISTEN to get $50 off your purchase of $500 or more. That's code LISTEN at BlueNile.com for $50 off your purchase. BlueNile.com, code LISTEN.
Quality sleep is essential. That's why the Sleep Number Smart Bed is designed for your ever-evolving sleep needs. Need a bed that's firmer or softer on either side? Helps you sleep at a comfortable temperature? Sleep Number smart beds let you individualize your comfort, so you sleep better together. J.D. Power ranks Sleep Number number one in customer satisfaction with mattresses purchased in-store. And now, save 50% on the Sleep Number limited edition smart bed for a limited time. For J.D. Power 2023 award information, visit jdpower.com/awards. Only at a Sleep Number store or sleepnumber.com.
The indigenous people are often caricatured as being, stunned into inaction, marveling so much at the European arrivals that they believe that they're gods, you know, this kind of thing. These stories that Europeans absolutely loved sharing afterwards, but that don't really have any basis in evidence. Actually, we see that, the Mexica, for instance, in Mexico, quite quickly realized that these people weren't gods, that they were people who came from another place, that they had more powerful weaponry than they did. And they worked pretty hard to adapt as fast as they could, change their tactics in warfare, change the way they dealt with these people. So the Mexica quite quickly begin fighting the Spanish in their canoes, zigzagging so that the Spanish guns can't target them so easily. They begin using house-to-house warfare, kind of urban warfare, rather than meeting them on the battlefield where the Spanish horses have the advantage. Yeah. And the Inca do the same thing. The Manco Inca, who's a kind of leads an insurgency of the Inca against the Spanish occupation, learns to ride a horse within years of the Spanish arrival. They begin using muskets and stealing Spanish guns and using them. The story of the contact between the old world and the new world is one of two land masses encountering each other after a gap of about 24,000 years. And it being almost like a head-on collision where the advances those two populations had made in the meantime would determine which one would survive the encounter.
Thinking about technology and the advances that they had, I can't help thinking about everything that's going on at the moment as sort of in this year, in 2024. Yeah. And they found, I believe they were able to decipher a scroll that was unopenable because what was inside was so fragile. And somehow, by feeding it into a computer and using AI, they were able to read this scroll and start deciphering it. Yeah. As someone who looks at ancient civilizations and who's spent a lot of time, clearly, and a lot of thought, how do you feel about where we are now? Are you excited? Do you think this is going to leap us in our understanding forward a little bit?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, the scrolls being read. There was a competition to see which of the teams could most effectively read these scrolls from Pompeii that had been completely petrified almost in volcanic tephra. And many of the teams actually had quite effective readings of these scrolls. And the team that won was incredibly impressive. And it's even more impressive because we don't actually have that many primary sources from that era. They're virtually non-existent. Almost everything we have from the Roman period has been copied through the Middle Ages, often through multiple scribes. People think we have all these, original Roman documents, and we just don't. So, it's a hugely exciting moment. There have been advances as well in using things like machine learning for reading cuneiform, which is very exciting. Because of the 100, I think there's more than 100,000 fragments of cuneiform writing in the British Library, of which less than 10% has even been looked at. We just don't have, there aren't that many people in the world who read cuneiform. So we have this vast untapped body of text that, you know, these new technologies are going to allow us real insights into. So yeah, it's a really exciting moment.
What's the current deal with Tutankhamun? Because there's a chamber, if you haven't heard, there is a chamber behind the main chamber that we've all been looking at since they've done it up. But to get behind there and see what's in it and examine everything, you'd have to smash the wall. You'd have to ruin the other chamber. So I think they're like pointing digital things at it, aren't they, and trying to figure it out.
Mm. Yeah, that sounds really exciting. Yeah, there are a few sort of big unopened presence in archaeology like that.
I think Mary Beard has been on, and she's a big one for, you get to a point like Pompeii, she says, we need to leave it alone now. We've done what we can. And this is why I could, like, Charlie and I could never be archaeologists, because we're historians and we need to know everything. And she's like, now we'll just leave it. And 100 years from now, when we're gone, someone else will figure something amazing out. And I'm like, yeah, but then I won't know.
Yeah, that's the thing. Yeah, there's also the tomb of Qin Shi Huang in China, who was the first, the first emperor of China, really, who united what we think of as the Chinese landmass. And he was buried in an enormously opulent tomb that supposedly had booby traps with crossbows, you know, primed to shoot anyone who opened it. That was supposedly a big replica of China, mapped on the floor, with rivers of liquid mercury flowing around his tomb. Whoa. That represented the Yellow River and the Yangtze River.
Yeah.
And it's just a huge mound currently in China where they've tested the soil and found that there is actually a really heightened level of mercury in the soil, such that archaeologists are nervous about opening it.
So we were filming World War Weird, and we were talking about Tamerlane and about how Stalin basically dug the mummy up, and when they got to the tomb, it said across like the arch on the door, go away and leave me alone or else. And then when they broke in and found the sarcophagus or whatever, there was another warning. It was like, no, really, mess with my tomb and I will mess with you. And he decided he was going to fly it up and down the in an aeroplane, like not on a stick, which would have been funny, but he put it in an aeroplane and had it flown up and down the eastern front to see if it made a difference. Apparently very shortly after the messing of the mummy is when the Nazis invaded Russia. So I like to think that was Tamerlane. I warned you bugger.
My gosh. You know who you'd send in if you've got a booby trapped tomb that you want to have looked at? You know who should
go on?
The Sticky Bandits from Home Alone.
Yeah. Yeah, they're faced pretty much.
They'll be fine. If they get an iron in the face, they'll be okay. So it's a good idea.
I think you should you have to move up the leagues, you know. If you can't break into just a suburban American house, then you shouldn't be breaking into Tamerlane's tomb.
Yeah, if you can't deal with booby traps devised by a 10-year-old, maybe this is not the gig for you.
Although we're already preconditioned to laugh at whatever happens to them. So I'm down with it. We haven't talked about China. That's not just one civilization, is it?
No, I mean, China's one of those stories in history that's just seen this endless, you know, continuity of dynasties, with significant, you know, breakpoints where everything comes apart. But yeah, I've looked at specifically at the Han dynasty in China, which is like roughly contemporaneous with the Roman Empire, and was the first, you know, really expansive empire of China that moved outside the central plains. That was about 200 BC to 220 AD. And what's really interesting about them is that they are the first empire to really open up the Silk Road, which is one of the main engines of progress, technological exchange, linguistic exchange that take place in the old world. And they even sent one traveller called Gan Ying, who travelled the entire length of the Silk Road from China. And he'd been told that there was an empire on the other side of the world that the Chinese had heard about, and they really wanted him to go and find out what was going on over there. And so he travels for months and months and eventually reaches what they call Da Qin, or Greater China, but we know as Rome. he meets the edge of the Roman Empire and writes down this wonderful little account of the first encounter of these empires on either side of the continent, where he says that they have a wonderfully organized postal system that particularly impresses him.
The hallmark of any great civilization, yeah, obviously.
You've got to have the mail arrive on time.
So as someone who's looked at, you know, all these various civilizations through time, especially looking at, you know, their declines, are they run in the same way? Are they all administered in the same way? Are they all empires with an emperor? Is there one guy, and I'm guessing mostly we're talking about a guy here, in charge, like a kind of like a monarchy, or are they hereditary dynasties? How do they mostly work, or are they all completely different?
Yeah, I mean, every society is really different. A lot of the story of history, as you say, is the story of these kinds of totalitarian empires, you know, places like ancient Egypt or Sumer, Assyria, where the king is, you know, the commander-in-chief, he's the head of the national religion, he owns all the land. The kind of despotic monarch, I suppose, yeah, you could say. But there are exceptions to that. But one significant one being Carthage, which was run by an absolutely Byzantine sort of system of different committees. They had two consuls who ruled at any one time. They had one committee called the Council of the 104, and also a Senate. This Carthage was a trading empire. It was a place that put a lot of store in wealth. And so it was run as this kind of merchant democracy, where like powerful families vied for these positions of power. And part of the reason for this lack of hereditary monarchy may have been that they drew their origins back to a queen, Dido, who died without any heirs. So there was never anyone who could say, I'm the true heir of Dido, you know, I'm the true the true descendant of Dido, you know, I have the hereditary right to rule. And so it may be that in that sense that founding myth had a role in perpetuating this kind of quasi-democratic system.
And that was something that Rome was almost experimenting with at the beginning, until you get the Caesars and you get the dictators for life.
Yeah.
And then they come up against Carthage, don't they? Is it Rome versus Carthage, and that's why we see Carthage fall?
Yeah, that's absolutely right. Yeah, I mean, there's even been speculation that the Roman system of, you know, two ruling consuls concurrently was modelled on the Carthaginian system. You know, Carthage from about 800 BC for 600 years is the preeminent power in the Mediterranean. They're the America of their day. You know, their fleet is the most powerful. It's unchallenged, and they have this empire that stretches from southern Spain to Libya and has Corsica, Sardinia, and the Balearic Islands, Majorca, and so on. They're incredibly wealthy. Their city is enormous. The Roman Republic, when it begins, is possibly somewhat modelled on Carthage, but is also allied to Carthage initially. You know, both of them see a mutual enemy in the Greeks, who are also a kind of merchant, trading, settling empire, or more like an interconnected series of states. But Rome and Carthage are initially quite happy to see each other fighting their common enemy. But once the Greeks are more or less expunged from Italy and Sicily, Carthage and Rome come into this inevitable conflict, which leads to three Punic Wars and the eventual sacking and complete destruction of Carthage.
Is there, when you start looking at the decline of these, because you cover so many and not just one period, do you see a pattern to the decline?
Yeah, I mean, I think it can be tempting to over-systematize these things, and I think a lot of other writers have fallen into that trap in the past, where you come up with your nice, neat little system for how societies collapse, and then it becomes a game of kind of just picking the evidence that fits your system. and telling the story to match that. I try to avoid that. And I think the message I want to get across is that the collapse of every society is an extremely complex event that necessarily takes place in a different way. But that's not to say that there aren't rhyming elements in some of these stories. For one thing, a lot of the stories involve some element of climate change. So this usually takes the form of drought, which was a fact of life in the ancient world. But if the droughts were too long, too frequent, or too inconsistent, then this could lead to a societal collapse. Because really, without water, any society will come apart. So in the Mayan collapse, in the Assyrians, Sumerians, these are all cultures that went through extended periods of drought.
So as a 17th century historian, right, there's certain things that I watch happening in the news, and it really floats my boat. So, you know, oh, a plague, wonderful. Now I can imagine what it's like to live through that. Brexit, this is just like when they cut the king's head off. I find that quite exciting, and I look for parallels and enjoy that. As someone who looks at great civilizations and their decline, what are you watching at the moment?
Well, yeah, it's also very tempting to start seeing those rhymes in current events. You know, obviously the challenge of the next century will be climate change. You know, we're conducting a kind of massive, unplanned experiment on our planet's atmosphere, transferring gigatons of carbon since the Industrial Revolution into our atmosphere in a way that, you know, couldn't but change dramatically the makeup of our climate. A lot of those changes are already locked in. You know, if we stopped emitting carbon overnight tomorrow, the planet would continue to warm well into the next century. So we're going to see quite dramatic changes in things like how food is produced, the livability of certain climate zones. And what we see in a lot of these collapses that we've looked at in Fall of Civilizations is that you get a kind of cascading systems collapse. So this is a term that's used in systems theory that could apply to an internal combustion engine or a church bake sale or an entire society, where simply one part of the system fails and passes stress onto other parts of the system that in turn become overloaded and fail in turn, leading to a kind of cascade through the whole system. We see this, for instance, in the Khmer Empire, which saw their complex system of water management completely disintegrate in a matter of decades, and other societies we've looked at. And I think when you look at modern society, we have an incredibly interconnected system of global trade, that things like, you know, trouble in the Red Sea and the Suez Canal can really like bring into high relief. Suddenly we realize that our entire society is built on large boats moving from place to place, and that it really only takes a small amount of disruption to have quite big knock-on effects. And I think as the stresses begin to, you know, increase on every one of these systems, we could look at some quite significant cascading failures in the future. But what that could look like, we don't know. We shouldn't. I'm not Nostradamus, and I can't get into like predicting what exactly is going to happen.
Thank you so much for walking us through so much history, Paul. I mean, I don't think we normally get such a wide range of, you know, of dates in one single podcast.
Oh, cheers, guys. Yeah, nice to talk to you.
Really enjoyed it. And the book is, when is the book out? When can people get it?
It's coming out 24th of April in the UK and in July in the US.
Fantastic. Thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you very much.
Our incredible guests give us 45 minutes of their time to join us and talk about their work or their new book. This is just a small taster. As a result, we have launched our very own bookshop on bookshop.org, where you can find our guests' latest books, you can support them, and you can support us on History Hack. 10% of every sale via our bookshop supports the podcast and allows us to keep going and bring you more top-of-the-line guests. You can find our bookshop at bookshop.org/shop/historyhack or search for us in the shop section. Thank you so much for your continued support. We really appreciate our listeners and supporters. So make sure you get down to the bookshop and grab yourselves a new book.